welcome to another Innovation Forum podcast with me, Toby Webb. And joining me today is John Grant, author of Greener Marketing. So welcome to the podcast, John. How are you?
Not bad at all, thank you.
John, you've been working in marketing communications for a long time. I remember your 2007 Green Marketing Manifesto book, and you've got a new book out in paperback, the Greener Marketing book, which came out in August. Before we talk about sustainability in marketing, just tell our audience a bit about yourself, how you've come to be where you are today, and your history in marketing and comms.
So I grew up, if that's the right term, in advertising agencies. And I worked at some large agencies that worked with big clients like Unilever, NatWest Bank. I moved to another agency that had a real focus on planning and consumer psychology and focus groups, which was the main thing I did there. And then I worked with clients ranging from Amnesty International to Volkswagen Cars. And then a group of us started an agency in the 90s, which became briefly famous. We were featured in Fast Company magazine and Harvard Business Review, partly because we had such a unusual way of working with what you would now our office looked a bit like WeWork, but that was quite unusual in the 90s. But we're also a shareholder cooperative, and we were one of the first in the industry to look into sustainability. We worked with Anita Roddick's Body Shop, as well as some very conventional clients like HSBC, who were also actually at the time interested in sustainability. We produced the first report that I'd ever seen about sustainability and marketing, and we audited ourselves. And I left that in 99 to go and work in the heady world of the dot-com boom, soon to be the dot-com crash, and had a mix of clients. And during the intervening time from then to now, I've written 8 books, and I've tended to write books. I'm basically, I guess my core skill base and expertise is in marketing and communication and brand strategy, innovation, things like that. But since 2000, one of my big clients from that previous agency was IKEA. Our local country manager went on to be the president of the company, and he called a few of us into a project all about their sustainability. And that question came up again and again. And the big conversation with IKEA was, well, how do we engage with it? We're doing a lot in our supply chain. They had done about 12 years of work to, in the boss's words, put the house in order. But actually, how do we communicate this? And we, way back then, were talking about issues like greenwash that I'm sure we'll talk about now. And I've tended to write books to help me and my clients clear up areas of hotly contested development and confusion. You know, several of my books have dealt with what digital and things like postmodernism meant for marketing, where, well, it's actually not really fair to say it's your brand, it actually belongs to consumers. And times have been changing. I wrote one book after Arab Spring where I went and interviewed a load of people, mostly in the Middle East, about what just happened. And they were sort of technologists, furniture makers, and whatever. But I thought this was potentially really interesting. There were a lot of interesting brands and marketing campaigns coming from that region that had a very different ethos and flavor, and there seemed to be a new generation. But 3 of those 8 books have been about sustainability, and all of them, I hope, have been quite ethically grounded. And it seemed high time recently to write another book, because whatever I wrote in 2007, there were so many new things happening. And also a massive return in interest. If you look at Levels, Ipsos's global survey of climate concerns, they were 85% of the global public were concerned or very concerned in 2005. And by 2019, 87% were. And through the financial crisis and other distractions, that had dipped to about 50%, but it sprung right up the agenda. So a lot of people wanted to do something in this space, and there were lots of new questions. There was the plastics documentary and single plastic bans. There was plant-based foods, loads more greenwashing, and all this stuff about purpose and brands having a cause and all of this. So it seemed like a good time, again, a hotly contested area that was quite confusing, to gather the best that I could find of what's working and put it between a couple of cover pages.
What are the headlines from the new book? We did some research last year with Ipsos, where we took some of Ipsos's data and sort of repurposed it, and they did some original research looking at what 3 different age groups of young consumers thought about sustainability. And I imagine it won't surprise you to hear that the younger they were, the more radical they were, and the less they cared about your business case. Is that your assessment of where things have moved since your 2007?
Well, I gave a presentation a couple of days ago, and I think the first or second chart said, if you want to change something, ask a 15-year-old. And there's definitely a new generation coming through. There was an article in The Guardian last year where Simon, somebody, the journalist, his core thought was 41% of the world are under 24 and they're angry. If you sort of think back at points in history where there have been melting pots of baby boom young generations, you can think about, for instance, America in the 60s and 70s, where a new generation came up with a generation gap of values, and then some other things lighting a fire under, like, you know, at that point, nuclear disarmament, Vietnam and so forth, but, you know, real hot points of contest. And today we have climate change, government corruption, Black Lives Matter. There are new fault lines, but there's definitely a big factor in that the younger you are, the more liberal and the more sustainable your mindset is, and the less you comprehend why, you know, there's quite a lot of graffiti around the world that says things like no future. And you have a sense that not only is there not a future that you can look forward to, but actually it's been stolen from you. So there's quite a lot of anger as well as sort of positive desire for change. So I think that is a factor, but the Edelman Trust Barometer looked at this, and so did another Ipsos survey. And when I recut the data, I didn't see a huge difference. The number of measures, like the leaders of society don't care about me, the system is loaded against me, it's unfair and I want change, those attitudes are held by 70 to 80% of people across the world. And there wasn't a huge difference between a 20-year-old and a 50-year-old on any of those measures. Younger people, students, have started every revolution in history, and them and some sailors from the Leningrad docks. It's not necessarily a view that is only held by the young, but of course, when you're a new generation, then perhaps you're all more able to confront it, less stake in it.
Very interesting. On the sort of sense of negativity you mentioned earlier, is that a concern that there's this sort of nihilist approach to action which can perhaps backfire, that there's too much negativity around? And is that something that your book aims to tackle in some way?
I'm definitely in the positivity camp. There was a huge, actually positive role in this whole ecosystem for direct action, activist organizations, civil disobedience. The effect that a consumer crisis has on a brand and board, when they start to see their share price falling because they're in the media over something they've done, and somebody is very angrily taking them to task for it, has a big role. It's not really my field. I'm not in that activist campaigning marketing thing. I am occasionally. I've worked with the non-GM fringes on some social media campaigns, and I've done some things to protect the bees and, you know, other stuff. But I tend to take the positive, encouraging, supporting, we're all in the same boat and let's make sure this hasn't got too many holes in it sort of view. But I recognize that in a complete ecosystem, we do need alarm. We do need a sense. 2000 cities with climate strikes and protests was really helpful in getting the attention of world leaders and business leaders. And it creates a space where you and I can work.
Let's talk about your book and your look at greenwashing. We were talking earlier that in 2007, greenwashing was often quite inept and quite amusingly incompetent. Has it got more sophisticated now, and is it getting worse?
Can I preface that by answering your previous question? Because you started asking what's changed between then and now, and we talked about the new generation. That's definitely a factor. I was preparing for a panel recently. There were three panel discussions based on the grid in my previous book, which was sort of green, greener, and greenest. And greenest is the sort of radical new business model, tearing up the industry, disrupting thing. And when I broke the book in 2007, you had setting new standards, which were GE, Unilever, Marks and Spencer's. And then the further you went to the right, you were into speculative social ventures, little bitty things on the internet, and some sort of quite hopeful things, but they were quite small examples. Often an example in that column would be a single YouTube video that got a lot of views. Now, I think a lot of the action, you know, is fairly equally spaced across those. There are people setting standards, but quite aggressive standards like science-based targets without offsetting. But there are really mainstream brands and players playing in that third column and reinventing their industries with circular economy models and so forth. And I think what's hopeful in the current situation is that very big organizations with the potential to scale things and to affect global supply chains have come to the realization. I was at dinner with somebody from a big UK retailer who ran their sustainability. He was like, we spent 20 years pissing around with risk management, reporting, and basically tweaking. And we now realize that's just not fit for purpose. The nature of the interlocking set of crises we face call for radical innovation, disruption, and change. And a lot of people are using the word regenerative rather than sustainability. And there's a sort of sense of a paradigm shift. So I think the most hopeful thing is that very large organizations are engaging seriously in things that can. There's a way of cutting the carbon footprint of the world where you find about 70-80% of it is heavy stuff like infrastructure, energy, transportation, and so forth. And the organizations that control large parts of that, who may have consumer-facing brands that have, you know, associated behaviors and trends, but being able to fix the factories and the roads and the length of the supply chain and the way in which stuff is grown, if it's grown, and so forth. A small example from the book would be in trainers. Like 10 years ago, if I was writing about trainers, I would, of course, be featuring whatever was at the time the fashionable vegan trainer. And we've seen recently Allbirds with at least the top of the shoe made from wool, and brands like Veja, who do wild rubber sourcing in the Amazon and so forth, very fashionable, very relevant, very French, worn by members of the royal family and so forth. But they're actually quite small. The big success in trainers has been Adidas, who worked with Parley, originally created an ocean plastic-based shoe for Davos as a demonstration, you know, look what we can do. 3 years later, they're selling 11 million pairs of that shoe. It's a multi-billion business line. And they've incorporated the learning and working with that NGO into some circular economy principles that run right the way across what they do. And that's really shifting one industry and its entire supply chain really fast. And it's no longer the case that you have to wait for something niche to become cool and then your Coca-Cola, you can sort of buy it. But actually you're seeing those big players moving. And that inevitably, that changes the whole question about greenwash, because people are making really serious claims that they will be held account for. Microsoft is going to remove all the carbon that is ever emitted. So is Spotify. And you know, we talked before the call about recent announcements from players like Unilever, Nestle. Deforestation is obviously the one that's concerning a lot of people because it's the target that they're least making. And we sort of knew 20 years ago, looking at forestry when I worked with IKEA, that it is just, you know, along with child labor, it's phenomenally difficult to solve. It's not whatever the sustainability report says, actually managing that. You know, maybe if you're Cargill, you could have probably a bit more leverage, but you know, any one of the people that we speak to are often like 0.1% the soy produced in Brazil or whatever, and they just don't have the clout to shift it. But the greenwash piece, I found lots of examples of greenwash. One thing is that nobody ever would have done it at any point in history if it didn't work. And it's one of those things, just like fraud in public office works really well. And when they discovered the reason we've got Bolsonaro in power in Brazil is that there was a level of government-sponsored corruption that was so big that one of the judges described it as industrial. And everybody on the political spectrum in Brazil wanted change and they wanted to deal with corruption and they wanted some economic reform. They didn't necessarily all want Bolsonaro, but that was basically what it did for the previous government, which was, you know, tremendous shame for forests and supply chains and everything else. Going back to Chevron, Chevron was one of the earliest examples of greenwashing that was called out as greenwashing, and they did a series of television commercials about a butterfly farm that they'd sponsored, which one campaigner pointed out the butterfly farm was in a bay which they'd polluted and killed millions of mammals and birds, but they had a butterfly farm that they'd spent $500 on, and they spent $500,000 on a TV commercial. Those commercials were rightly slammed for greenwashing, but I also noted in my research that they won an Effie Award for advertising effectiveness. And companies like Shell are tremendously well-informed and work with very sophisticated marketing and research partners, and they must know that offering to plant trees to offset your egregious levels of emissions from your 4x4 vehicle. But they must know at some level that that works. But unfortunately for them, they're in a broader information ecosystem where not only are they going to get attacked, but even the Scottish government is going to get attacked for hosting these forests, and because it is outrageous. The thing I said about Beyond Petroleum in the previous book is you're not allowed to put a lettuce in the window of a butcher and a big sign saying vegetarian. It just has to be proportionate. But there are lots of current examples of greenwashing. And I do think there is still a low level of education in marketing departments. For years at conferences, I used to show a tin of Lavazza coffee, which had a Rainforest Alliance sticker on it, and then a thing around the lid that said 100% sustainable, or whatever the Italian word. And I was like, how have they cracked it? I mean, cold fusion? Who knows? How have they made this tin of material and this grown coffee 100% sustainable? I want to know, because that's absolutely genius. I discovered recently, when writing about greenwash in my latest book, that in the Rainforest Alliance, you have to mark a packet of commodity with what proportion of the contents are sustainably sourced. So, for instance, if you have a custard and you have some Rainforest Alliance vanilla in it, you have to say it's 0.1% of the contents of this. And in this case, 100% of the coffee in the pot was all from Rainforest Alliance certified sources. And it was just some copywriter who'd gone, well, it's 100% sustainable then, isn't it? I think a lot of greenwashing is by accident, but there is a level of marketing education, but it still does a tremendous amount of disservice, both to the credibility when things are called out of the entire profession and sustainability, and also to brands. It can do direct brand damage.
So what's the solution with marketing teams? I know one senior executive at an FMCG brand who told me that because of the fast turnover of marketing people in brands, it's often the advertising agencies that retain the kind of cultural memory of what the brands are actually about. But that doesn't seem like a good enough answer to me. How else can marketing in corporate evolve to take on greater understanding of these complexities and avoid examples like the one you just cited?
It's the case that in global FMCG companies that the people doing brand management are often in the first 10 years of their career. And there's a lot of advantage to that. They tend to employ a lot of very overpowered, highly qualified, smart people. And that can drive innovation. Occasionally, you do get like a family business where the marketing team have been in place for 30 years. It's sort of like a lot of smaller market towns have a department store that looks like it did in the 70s. And that is for modern branding and staying relevant and staying up with this year. They need to really have people who understand how to authentically represent their brand in places like TikTok. So they need that fresh blood and innovation. Somebody somewhere has to hold a knowledge of what the values of the brand are. And I think separate question, somebody needs to be able to educate them in a reasonably rigorous way on what the facts are on innovation, on sustainability, and marry that with the innovation. So you will find 26-year-olds running global brands. And in terms of the actual values of the brand, I think a lot of that today is carried in as much as it's valid and it's not just something that somebody's made up on a PowerPoint chart with a picture of an onion on it and some words. If it's valid, then it lives in the memories and the values of consumers. And I've seen a number of situations where brands have been called out by consumers because they don't think they're conforming to the values that they expect from that brand. And I spoke to you about this before when I worked with Innocent. They did a partnership with McDonald's. And some of their core early adopter, slightly more Islington Green consumers were outraged by this in a way that really took the management of Innocent at the time aback, because they checked with Greenpeace. Greenpeace said, oh no, McDonald's are pretty good these days. I think they won an ethical corporation award around that time, but they were Greenpeace's global partner in reforestation, have reasonably good supply chain and tracing, and whatever else you say, I think your awards or somebody's ethical corporation award said at least they're better than Burger King. They had actually, and I was on the Observer Ethical Awards where there was a huge debate about them, but they had fantastic policies. And also, the managing director of Innocent pointed out, we're not allowed under UK antitrust law. We can't tell them not to sell their products. If they buy it from a wholesaler and they sell it, that's up to them. You know, can't stop it being sold in Shell garages or strip clubs or anything else. It's, you know, nothing to do with us. And none of that washed for their consumers. And it was because people invested a lot of hope in a company which they thought was absolutely authentic and was true to these kind of family human way of doing business and the way of speaking and so forth. And so when they did something that didn't conform to that, they were attacked for it. That cultural memory comes back to brands every time you do a focus group, because people will say, that looks really cool, but it just isn't you.
So when you see things like Burger King launching a low methane burger, what do you think?
I haven't seen that. I'm going to go and check it straight after this call. The thing is that, like most of the other major brands, they have excellent ad agencies, but if the reality doesn't stack up, then it doesn't work out. It's like somebody dressing up for an occasion, but it's just not them. Example I picked up in the book is that they did a very well-crafted mental health month campaign in America in a very American style of knocking other brands. They did something that they called the Unhappy Meal range, and they were full of, and all the Unhappy Meals were sort of acronyms that people would use online to say unhappy, but in modern lingo. They made really excellently crafted videos, and it looked like a really well put together campaign, and their brand partner was very credible, and they did a lot of good in raising awareness of mental health, and it's okay, it affects lots of people. The trouble was, within moments of this launching, there were people all over their employee base posting on public websites saying, my boss wouldn't give me a mental health minute off, I had to leave because of stress and bullying, etc. So there was a huge immediate backlash, and there was nothing really to back it up. All they'd done is written a check and made some ads. I met the head of people years ago at McDonald's when I was trying to get him to adopt my sustainability behavior change scheme. And I was gobsmacked actually by how much they do as an organization that they don't boast about. Like, for instance, they are the second biggest educator in terms of getting people O-levels and A-levels in this country after the British government. They ensure that a very large employee population continue and finish their education. He'd been put through business school by the company and so forth. I was saying things like, oh, well, to use our system, people would have to have computers. And said, that's fine. There's two computers in every staff room, which are used where people are updating their training and other courses. Going back to the methane, they're selling things made of beef, and there is an inherent sustainability conflict within that. That actually Max Burgers have been very interesting in taking on, that we could also talk about the Impossible Burger and so forth. But within that, I went away thinking all my prejudices about Mac Jobs and the potential for that to create a oppressive organization that micromanages people and doesn't treat them well have been completely confounded by somebody who, you know, as a human being, I genuinely believe has had the career of his life in this place and is setting out to help other people do that. But if you have that internal reality, if McDonald's had done a mental health month, there wouldn't have been that huge backwash, because they would have been, from what I'm describing, if it's true, and you'll get loads of comments from people who've worked at McDonald's that tell us whether it is or not. One of the things that marketing has done for the last 140 years is be the icing on the cake. Be the packaging design, the Mr. Kipling that makes the food look less industrial and so forth. And sustainability is all cake. It's either a good cake or not a good cake. It's either full of sugar or it's good for you. Apparently, by the by, I discovered during lockdown that banana bread, there was a great article in The Guardian said that this is the most successful cake in the world, and its great success is calling itself bread. I was quite shocked when I came to make it how much sugar you put in the recipe. Marketing has always been that process of calling a cake a bread.
Talking of ingredients of both cake and bread, let's talk about palm oil. It is a much maligned crop, as we know, but like it or not, the reputation is really bad. Having said that, there are, as you and I both know, some really good examples of improving practice. What's your advice to the palm oil industry or those using palm oil about how they could talk to consumers about the positive progress that can be made in the area?
Well, this is where you get into the real interest in this. I mean, there's a number of examples in the book. At one end of the scale, you've got Iceland's Rangtang banned commercial, popular uprising, Iceland are going palm oil free, etc., etc. And there's the GMO Frankenstein foods public protest piece of it. And at the other end, you've got Malaysia had their palm oil council ad banned for egregious claims about our forests of beautiful palms are hosting wildlife and absorbing CO2. And it's like, yeah, but it's a plantation, it's not a forest, and there's 1,000 times less biomass and much less room for pollinating insects and other things that you're spraying. And anyway, it was banned as a egregious claim that this is the world's most beautiful natural product. And of course, oil was originally the virgin forest that got trapped and turned into a hydrocarbon. It's all natural. The really interesting debate is in between. I quote Jonathan Porritt in the book because he was really angry about the Iceland thing. And he said, look, we're making headway on this. It's a really, really difficult issue. We've got major players at the table. We are not using up our quotas of responsible palm oil, and we need the public to get behind it. And this kind of childish, destructive, throwing the toys out of the cot is doing the whole thing a disservice, because we're making progress in the middle. And there is the middle in everything. You know, the people watching this drive cars, use bars of soap and eat cereals and other things with palm oil and so forth. And we're all implicit in this, and we're trying to move quite quickly through a transition, quite a thoroughgoing transition. And it may or may not be that in the long term, palm farmed in one way or another is a part of that. But what Jonathan Porritt's other point was that he'd, I think, commissioned, as part of working with the RSPO, a comparative life cycle analysis of palm and every other oil. And it was the best in terms of CO2 and energy inputs and land use. And it's not like we can go from that to several other alternatives, which are so much better at the moment. I mean, rapeseed is what we buy as vegetable oil, and there you've only got to drive around the M25 to see the fields of yellow and wonder whether that's another monocrop and another story to be told. The move towards agroecology and creating business models and farming, which is more forest and soil friendly, and also innovations like vertical farming and other things which free up some lands and shorter supply chains. There's a whole complex of things that are moving in supply chain towards regenerative and positive agriculture. And the debate around palm will obviously continue, because there are terrible shots in, like, the Attenborough documentary that was on a few weeks ago. They've got these huge aerial shots of just enormous land masses of, I think in that case, the crop was soy. That does need to be addressed. It's so easy in a heightened emotional, political, difficult area to demonize something. The bigger question, which is surrounding every brand and all of your listeners, and I know everybody is tied in knots by, is deforestation, because we, through the biggest calendar coincidence since the Y2K bug, everybody set 2020 targets, and everybody at once was accountable for not meeting their targets on deforestation. And the various reports pointed out the very large proportion of those, and the Consumer Goods Forum, you know, all of their members and so forth. And indeed, it wasn't one of the SDGs, zero net deforestation by 2020. And so there are renewed commitments and renewed focus on that. And I think that is looming. If you look at the effect of the ocean plastic issue, the one Attenborough documentary, there is a huge amount of public attention and concern that is turning towards ecosystem restoration, if I put it positively. And brands are going to have to be very smart and move very fast on that. And it's difficult because the physics, the mechanics of supply chain. Nestle's defense was all, you know, don't talk to us, talk to Cargill.
We seem to be moving from defense to offense, as the Americans might call it, in the sense that companies seem to be wanting to, and rightfully, I think, to turn it from a we're not doing so many bad things to we are contributing to a net positive, restorative, regenerative society and set of landscapes. How do you talk to consumers about that, though? You know, eco-labelling was tough enough, and as we know, it hasn't really worked. Although we understand, I think, all of us, why it's been done. How do you talk to consumers about these really complex terms like regenerative and restorative and so on?
There's a sort of cascade. Regenerative agriculture, an idea that's been kicked around amongst people like permaculturalists since the 1980s, 5 years ago, if you said regenerative agriculture, you'd find yourself in a room with people like Patagonia and Dr. Bronner, who were sponsoring outlying. And there is quite an interesting heartland for this in America, like the farm to fork thing. It's a very pastoral harvest festival, Thanksgiving sort of society. And there is a romance to almost like farming done the old way with fallow fields and the no-till and things like that actually appeal to the whole Whole Foods Thrive Market portion of America that really quite like farming and have an affection for things done that way. So there's a sort of natural pathway through some of those channels. But it's the kind of thing that trickles down. At the moment, we've got Unilever announced, I think 6-8 weeks ago, they updated their next set of sustainable living objectives. And the statement they put out about climate, a lot of it was about regenerative farming and doing that in the supply chain. And it is exciting because the combination of the potential impact of that on the appalling prospect of losing a million species through extinction, and there's a reason it's called Extinction Rebellion. I do think that will mobilize public attitudes around consumer markets for a long time, be a potent force, but also the fact that nature-based solutions, that regenerative farming methods like biochar can genuinely turn something that has been a negative part of the global carbon accounts into something that's positively absorbing and sequestering carbon. The two halves of my book, the two sections of the book, are actually called Not Bad and Net Good. And net good can be on a global footprint scale. If you're a soft drinks company, you're probably tracking things like water, but also carbon deforestation and so forth. But it can also be, I feel like your brands are making a positive contribution to my life. Thanks, Unilever, for the campaign for Real Beauty. That makes my daughter feel better about herself and so forth. The other thing that actually really is very helpful is that competition hasn't gone away. I wrote a whole book on cooperative models and Linux and Wikipedia, but competition is a major factor, and Microsoft will have rushed to be the first tech company to come out to make their carbon positive, carbon removal investment announcement, because they didn't want to be third. They didn't want to announce it after Google. And there is a healthy competition, which does tend to promote the thing. We never quite found a better term for sustainability, but I imagine there is probably a more consumer-friendly term than regenerative.
Well, if you can work out what that is, you'll do very well.
I was once invited on, there was on the eve of the EU banning shale sands oil from Europe, from Canada, there was a debate on the Canadian equivalent of Newsnight about how this public relations disaster came around where Europe was unfairly banning their beautiful products. And I was talking to the researcher on the show because they phoned me up and said, do you want to be on the show? And I said, well, what are you looking for? And they said, well, this is clearly a perception issue, and maybe being called tar sands seems to be very unattractive. So I said, are you proposing that you call it beach oil? I said, actually, that's exactly what, you know, when you come on the show and say that. And I said, no. Here's a friend of mine who works at Freud's PR and communication. You can talk to him about thorny PR issues. But I was talking to a clean tech investor. She worked for a small company in Amsterdam called Global Clean Tech Capital. And she said, somebody somewhere, and I found out since it was a couple of VCs in California, did the entire industry a huge service where we stopped calling it renewables, which is where everybody lost their money in the 70s and the 90s and various other times, and started calling it clean tech, because clean tech sounds really cool. It sounds like Silicon Valley. And I do think there are the need for a new vocabulary and some new terms around sustainability that are intuitive. Like when Obama 08 was out, he was just using big words like change, hope. We can talk about the subsequent terms of office, but you actually knew where you were with them. But it wasn't like the old Democrats talking about schools and hospitals. They managed to wrap it up and market it in a new way. And I definitely think there's a little bit of work at the edge of all of this, but it's still icing. We really need to fundamentally shift the cake. And if you get that story right, then the marketing is substantially easier.
Is there a role for brands and companies in sponsoring better research? I'm just looking at the new Nature Conservancy report, which has just been sent to me this morning, and they've got a chart about harmful subsidies and global financial flows towards biodiversity conservation, $451 billion in agriculture subsidies, $1 billion in nature-based solutions and carbon markets. there is a public policy blockage here in a huge way. You know, fossil fuel subsidies, agricultural subsidies, companies are starting to talk about slowly how systems need to be changed to push money in the right direction.
Yes.
But then, to me, they are nowhere near bold enough. And frankly, it's sticking plaster on a shrapnel wound until they start talking about these systemic problems. Because I think they don't really know how to do it, and they sort of think it's not really our place, and who are we? We just sell soap, or we just sell bread, or we sell, you know, what we produce palm oil. What are your views?
A friend of mine years ago, he was like one of those management coaches. He had been head of leadership development at Goldman Sachs, and then he was like coaching boards of directors. And he used to take them on a journey that he called statecraft. And he would take boards of directors to see people like the former director of the CIA or a director of Greenpeace and so forth. Because he said, look, this is now the domain that you operate in and you need to be effective in this domain. And I would argue that what has changed with the current generation of business leaders is that they are willing, some of them, to grasp that nettle. Nigel Watson, for instance, CEO of Legal & General, is very forthright about the fact that his role and his company's role as the third biggest asset manager in the world, depending which year you measure it, is to make sure they're looking after funds for pension companies, and they need to make sure that their investments create a world that is worth retiring in. So they have huge programs around urban regeneration, affordable housing. They were 50% of the money for Salford Media City. They're doing huge things in Sunderland. But they're basically, there's no point in having a nice little nest egg if you can't go out the front door because of crime and social inequity and so forth. And he's actually gathered all of this under the heading inclusive capitalism. And then you've got the, I think, 300 and growing number of CEOs, including 60 from financial organisations, who signed the European Green Recovery Alliance commitments, and our IKEA, L'Oreal, Nestle, H&M, all sorts of business leaders are signing a pledge asking politicians to direct the next phase of massive government stimulus, the sort of New Deal money, to be a Green New Deal in ways that may at times cost them money, but they're coming out in a concerted way and saying, we want to be part of playing in a green economy, and we're doing our best to develop our business in line with the Paris targets and, you know, all kinds of other targets, but we need you, government, to stop perversely subsidizing oil industry and all of the other things that we need to transition from. I think that's improving, but you're right, there would still be a view that I'm only a CEO. But Paul Polman's great tenure at Unilever was all about actually taking a less passive view of the sort of executive as somebody who just executes the wishes of shareholders. And if you've got an activist shareholder on your back, bad luck.
It's very interesting now to see companies committing more cold, hard cash to these things, which they haven't been doing in the past. And I think that really is a sign of leadership. And we're going back to the biodiversity conservation finance, and this report says, but there's just over 100 billion in global biodiversity conservation financing last year, but the needs are just under a trillion. And companies can obviously only make up a tiny proportion of that. But I suppose those hard cash commitments over time, that sends a serious message, doesn't it?
And it does, and they parcel out amongst their brands. So it is a form of marketing. So Unilever now have a 1 billion climate and nature restoration fund. Microsoft have a billion funds that they put up for carbon removal. Bank of America put up a billion funds for community equity and community projects in the wake of Black Lives Matter. And, you know, a billion is a lot of money. Actually, HSBC, I think their original climate fund was like half a billion, in what, 2005? And they had a similar water fund and so forth. You have to look into the details of those funds and how much of it is additional funding, rather than something being ring-fenced into, we're going to take a bunch of things we're doing and call it the climate fund. But what Unilever said is that we're going to make this fund available to our brands. Hellmann's apparently is very interested in real food and farming and educating people about food. Their somewhat punning slogan that we were joking about on LinkedIn the other day is, we're all on the side of food, which obviously, being a mayonnaise, you're usually at the edge of the plate. But they are seriously committing to educating people about how their tomatoes are grown and the ketchup and so forth. And they are able now to draw on a corporate fund if they have a sustainable tomato, getting people to farm their own tomatoes, whatever. When I walk into a room to have a conversation with managers in any type of business, there's sort of I was describing it to somebody who's happily married, but you know, if you're on the dating market, there's some that are good on paper. And you walk into some rooms and you go, I've been reading about this company's sustainability commitments for 20 years. I'm actually a big fan. And then the reality can be slightly disappointing. They've just had a series of really good consultants who've helped them craft their message and make the most of themselves. And you walk into some other places and you find companies that for some hearts and minds, roots and branch way, are a nice company that authentically in some way is attached to something human and means well. Maybe in a global agri business or something else. For example, Cadbury's, they just have Quaker Roots or something like that. Obviously now part of Mondelez or Kraft or whichever one it is, but as was. I was talking about scratching the surface and meeting somebody who ran people at McDonald's. You find that there is like real depth right through the organization, that there is something that is more bread in the bone that's about treating people well. Otherwise, you just get these reports where there are incredibly qualified people who are very adept at presenting a number of messages to a number of what they would call stakeholders. I think the thing at the moment that I look for is somebody in the leadership team who's had a bit of an epiphany. Like there's a brilliant blog from one of the leaders of BrewDog, James Watt, who said, look, we had a meeting. I think they had a meeting with David Attenborough and they were like quite shocked and they went into research and they realized we were really proud of our sustainability. We realized that we were massively part of the problem and nowhere near part of the solution. And we're now radically transforming what we do because we realize, oh shit, there actually is. When people use the word climate crisis, there actually is a crisis. And we've got a very limited time window to address it. And you will find people in organizations across the world who've come to that realization who are tremendously more helpful to this whole agenda than people are going, this is one of the things on my dashboard. It's one of my KPIs. I have to manage that. We're mainly in the business of shifting corn into sugar syrup or something else. But within that, we're regulated and accountable publicly and other stuff. So I do think not just in climate strikes, but there is a new radical mood of we really need to shift this. And wherever that realization is present, you can definitely make progress.
So let's finish off with a practical example on that topic. Walmart have just made a big announcement at New York Climate Week that they will use only renewable energy by 2035. Lots of companies are saying this, of course. Entire operations will be zero emission by 2040. I think they've also said they're not going to rely on offsets because offsets have a pretty bad reputation. Although I think they may be rehabilitated in the coming years. But at the moment, this still looks upon as a last resort very much. If you're advising Walmart on how to talk to the average Walmart consumer about this stuff, what would your advice be, John? Would you tell them to have big banners in the supermarket on the walls? Would you tell them to integrate it into their email marketing? Would it be part of everything consumers see? Or should it only be there when consumers are looking? Because maybe they don't want to overwhelm their discount shoppers.
It's a really good question. The Walmart's an interesting case. That announcement in the last week or so was no surprise whatsoever to anybody who'd been tracking their history for the last 20 years. There's a brilliant speech given by, was his name Lee Scott, the former CEO, who gave a speech about 21st century leadership. And he talked very personally about his and colleagues' lessons from Hurricane Katrina. And he describes climate. He said, I thought we were doing our bit. We're doing some recycling. We've got some policies in place. But we realized that climate is just a slow Katrina. And this wave of destruction is coming through the towns where we employ colleagues, the places that we sell people, the places that we source things. And that if something of our size isn't responsible for attending to this, who is? And it's a brilliantly written speech. I wouldn't be surprised if it was actually written for him by a member of the Obama team or something like that. It was around that time. It's a very rousing speech. And they did a number of concrete things. You'll remember the Walmart Index, where they got together a independent group of NGOs and academics to put together the best possible scorecard so that, you know, basically if you look at certification of goods, one of the reasons the eco labels for all their successors have been a dismal failure is they cover such a small proportion of the shopping basket. You've got some organic corn or some organic coffee or some fair trade eggs, but anything multi-ingredient like your tikka masala, which has like 200 supply chains, including materials coming into it, is just a nightmare to label. And they've taken that head on and said, we are going to create a sustainability standard which is able to transparently look down all of our supply chains. And we're pushing this, of course, on suppliers. We'll support them. So I wasn't surprised that they've made the latest commitment, because I regard them as a sort of a bit of a hidden gem. And I always like it when companies like Walmart and B&Q was the one in the UK that was incredibly forward on this. I like it when they do it, because they're not doing it just because they have garden reading consumers who want to feel better where they're sort of toting their Chianti and taking their holiday in Tuscany and flying there and flying their beans in from Kenya and other stuff. But actually, like McDonald's, in a sense, they didn't have to, but they are covering a much bigger rump of, you know, the mainstream economy. I don't know if they'd be well advised to. I mean, I think Tesco, who is similarly on the case and who claimed to be aiming to halve the footprint of the entire British shopping basket, and they're working with credible partners like WWF to deliver this, and they're primarily looking at issues like farming, food waste, and so forth. I think there's a very large part of what Tesco is doing which won't be visible to consumers and doesn't need to be, and it will still be the same great taste, the same great price, sold in shops that are convenient and have all the different things that your kids like, but they will be subtly changing things behind that in the supply chain to make it 50% better. And that's definitely a way to go. There's a lot of questions about the, for instance, the health profile of the Impossible Burger based on salt or saturated fat, or indeed, you know, the presence of GM soy and so forth. However, undoubtedly, the reason it won a UN Innovators Award is that on climate, what they've managed to do is match the Burger King Whopper for taste and deliver something without the impact of beef. And on that single measure, and they consciously, it's the Trojan horse strategy, they consciously set out to make something that as similar as possible to the things that the very mainstream people who aren't necessarily as engaged, if they're having a double Whopper for lunch, they're not necessarily part of the climate striking generational movement, and they are sort of meeting people where the problem is. It was really interesting strategically. One of the founders of Impossible Foods on this panel, and she said, look, all we've got to do is put the meat industry out of business, and it's not going to take that much, to be honest. Those huge feedlot, you know, things, the economics of that are so frail at the moment. You know, during COVID, there have been meat shortages in the US for the first time since the Second World War, and it is a very fragile industry, and rather like Oatly, they don't have to push very hard to ensure that we're getting most of our protein or all of our protein from sources like plants in 10 years' time. Walmart have had great partners and advisors over the years. They work with TerraCycle and others, and they've been doing things which are like subtle and delightful, like making toys out of upcycled packaging and things like that. They're little flourishes where you can see that they are doing a lot. I think if they want to move the hearts and minds of their mainstream audience, they're going to have to do something rooted in those sort of slightly Reagan faith, family, flag, local community things. Like the great Tesco marketing promotion of history was computers for schools. And there was an investigation. And one of the things I write about in the book is, if you're doing course marketing, make sure that the good you're doing is not like 999% you and like 0.1% or whatever the cause. But there was the expose of the computer for schools thing that showed that you had to spend £370,000 at Tesco to buy one PC for a school was a little concerning. And I think they would have to look at the proportion. It was something that moved mainstream mum, the Mumsnet world. And like everybody was, they weren't using their vouchers, giving them to somebody else in the queue. And Walmart needs to do things like that that makes sense to people about vegetable gardens for schools, local cycleways, things that make your life in your town nice, because talking about climate change probably isn't it. I applaud them for what they're doing. Like, I kind of implicitly believe it, because when you see somebody trying to do something that big, trying to do something in a concerted way for 20 years, it's the positive side of there's no smoke without fire.
We could talk all day, but this has been fascinating. Thanks so much. Where can listeners get your book from? I guess all good bookstores, Kindles and so on.
Yes, Waterstones, Amazon. It's coming out in the US. It's been out for some time in the UK. I've known some people in some other European markets who've ordered it from the UK. I think my publisher is right now or heading towards the Frankfurt Book Fair. So hopefully that will expand. But yes, Amazon, Waterstones, all good booksellers.
Greener Marketing by John Grant is the title and the name of the author. Listeners, do check it out. I'll put a picture of the cover up on the podcast. So, John, thanks so much for your time today.
Absolute pleasure.